Hello, Junkies. We have a sponsor for this week's episode, and they want the ad run in the middle of the show instead of at the beginning. Hey, man, you know the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. Am I right? So I will be popping back during a scene break in this episode to blab about Green Chef, which is awesome. So be prepared. There will be more story right after the ad. Hey, are you tuning into our Sigler in Place live streams every Tuesday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific time? A Real Girl and I will be streaming live. We talk about my fiction, we chat with junkies, we talk about current events, you know, like talking about the Seattle Kraken in the NHL. I wonder where they got that idea from. And the Washington football team. And generally, A and I then do bad comedy and laugh at fart jokes. So tune in at facebook.com/Scott Sigler, at youtube.com/Scott Sigler, or at twitch.tv/Scott Sigler. And if you're a Twitch user, go to that page, twitch.tv/Scott Sigler, and follow me so you know you're there. Here we go with our original Talkie Talk from 2007, which includes a story so far from the incomparable Cory Doctorow, sci-fi author and co-founder of the amazing site Boing Boing. Then you will hear episode 25 of the Nocturnal Throwback. Enjoy! Welcome to the free podcast novel Nocturnal. This is episode number 25. Nocturnal is a podcast-only novel. You can't buy in stores, and you can't peek at the end. Written and performed by Scott Sigler. More information and more free stories available at scottsigler.com. This book contains adult language, mature situations, and lots of violence. Hello, my junkies. We are running a little bit late this week. Those of you who actually get the episodes from scottsigler.com, you saw what the reason for the delay was. It was a time warp. That's right. I, once again, am right on time, while all of you are actually catapulted one day into the future. This episode is dropping when it's supposed to drop, which continues my 18-year-long streak of podcasting on time uninterrupted. However, since all of you got teleported to the wrong time zone, we'll get right into the story. I'm really excited about the story so far this week. I'm a big fan of this guy. Here's our story so far from the one, the only, Cory Doctorow.
Hi there, this is Cory Doctorow, the co-editor of BoingBoing.net and author of the new young adult science fiction novel Little Brother, a book about teenaged hackers who use technology to win back the Bill of Rights from the Department of Homeland Security. The book's coming out on April 29th from Tor Teens, and like all my books, it'll also be available as a free Creative Commons license download. Scott's even going to be folding it into this podcast feed in early May. The story so far. Aggie James was once nothing but a homeless bum, until he was kidnapped by Marie's children. In their lair beneath the streets of San Francisco, he's seen the horrors of the groom's walk and the hideous mommy. Hillary, a member of the cult, helped break Aggie out, but gave him a mission. Take a baby from the lair and find the child a loving home, or Aggie will take the walk and know mommy's love. Aggie's escape was cut short by a blow to the head, and it remains to be seen if he got help in time. Marie's children work as hitmen for Frank Lanza, boss of the San Francisco La Cosa Nostra. They were told to take out the Russian mafia, but the Russians turned the tables and tried to assassinate Lanza. Lanza survived and went into hiding, and now he has to talk to Sub-Chief Sean Robertson. Robertson has hard evidence that detectives Brian Clouser and Pookie Chang know about Marie's children. Lanza must make the call to let the detectives be, or have them killed. But Clouser and Chang aren't the only ones that know about Marie's children. Medical examiner Robin Hudson is closing in on the genetic picture of the cult. She and her mentor, Stone Mason, have isolated the bizarre Z chromosome and are about to put all the pieces together. The truth of Marie's children is about to be uncovered.
Pookie and Brian got into Pookie's car, which sat in the parking lot of San Francisco General Hospital. Brian stared out the window. Pookie did the same. Pookie didn't know what to say to the man. and not in small part, because Pookie's throat felt like he had swallowed 30 grit sandpaper soaked in burning gasoline. Pookie couldn't shake the disturbing feeling of Brian's hand on his throat. The strength of the fingers. The arm. Brian had picked him up as if he'd weighed 50 pounds, not 250. Brian could have crushed Pookie's windpipe with just a squeeze. Fuck, the way that grip felt, maybe he could have snapped the neck outright. Brian was in kick-ass shape, to be sure, but he was about 180 pounds, and physique-wise, he wasn't exactly hitting the roids. Had it been some panic-driven, adrenaline-stoked burst of strength? "Sorry about grabbing you like that," Brian said.
"Don't mention—"
The words locked up in Pookie's throat as they brought on a new blast of searing pain. Something might be fucked up in there, he didn't know. He spoke again, slower, softer.
"Don't worry about it."
"That crazy old fucker thinks I'm the devil," Brian said.
"I don't think the devil can bench press as much as you," Pookie thought.
Pookie looked at Brian. Bench press. Strength. Brian had picked Pookie up like a rag doll. He'd thrown big old Jason Green around like so much trash. But that wasn't the first time Brian had showed ridiculous strength. Back in the alley, where Alex Panos was killed. The dumpster. Brian had moved that dumpster all by himself, a dumpster that three men couldn't budge. And behind that dumpster were symbols on the wall drawn in human blood. Behind the dumpster, because the killer had moved it, drawn, then put it back. The killer had been strong enough to move the dumpster, just like Brian. And that witness to the Fisher murder, Claire Rosemary, her story about the wolfman and the snake face jumping down at least three stories. What if she wasn't crazy? What if she saw what she said she saw? How strong did you have to be to jump three stories and land on the ground unharmed? As strong as, say, someone who could move a dumpster by themselves? Or maybe as strong as Jebediah Erickson. That old man, that tiny old man, had taken out five cops just as casual as you please. Erickson had hit Pookie with a goddamn spin kick right out of a Jet Li movie. That had been strong, man. Pookie had never been hit so hard in his entire life. Pookie's fingertips gently probed the big bruise on the right side of his jaw. This case sucked. He was getting his ass kicked on a regular basis. Erickson. The Wolfman. The Snake Face. The Dumpster. Brian Clouser. Pookie suddenly did not want to be alone in a car with the ninja. Pookie's cell phone rang, making him jump. He fumbled for his phone. Brian turned to look at him.
"Pooks, you all right?"
"Yeah,"
Pooks managed before his throat locked up again. Then he just nodded and pulled out his cell phone. He swallowed, hoping the spit would ease the burning in his throat. He took a deep breath and answered.
"Jang."
"Pooks, it's back, Mr. Burns. You still at SFGH?"
"Yeah, with Brian."
"Good. Put this on speaker."
Pookie hit the speaker button, then held the cell phone between he and Brian.
"Listen, that APB we had out on the symbols found at the Boyko murder scenes turned up a strange hit. A bum in the Montgomery Street Muni station was carrying an infant wrapped in a blanket that was covered in those same symbols. Witnesses said he came off the tracks, tried to run outside. He fell and whacked his head. Baby and bum are on their way to General Hospital. Paramedics think the bum has a concussion. The baby they're bringing in to check out as well. Child services has already been called."
But wasn't that a little bit fucked up? A baby and a blanket with symbols that heralded death. Symbols that had been seen on and off in San Francisco for 100 years. A history of symbols. Timeline of symbols. Pookie thought back to what Chief Zoe had told him, back in the car, after he'd tried to get a warrant from Judge Rodriguez. "Then look something up for me," she had said. "Look up the murder rate in San Francisco in 1975. 30 years ago. That was also part of the timeline.
"BMB,"
Pookie said, each syllable heavy with pain.
"Do me a chart. Murders per year from 72 to 78.
"Sure thing, Pooks,"
BMB said.
"I'll have that for you in maybe half an hour. Chief Zoe is busy down on Columbus Street. This gangland thing is blowing up in the news. If she's going to hang us out to dry up Erickson's house, it'll be a little while. One more thing. Forensics checked out Erickson's knife. It was coated in silver dust, just like that arrowhead that killed Marco Gastineau.
Thanks, Pookie croaked, then hung up. Those symbols meant death, so why was this baby alive? No, they didn't mean death. They were protection against death. Protection against death by Savior. Timeline. Why couldn't he get that word out of his head? Pookie swallowed again, then cleared his throat. The pain was subsiding a little bit.
Brian, we gotta go back in. Talk to this bum.
Maybe you should go in. Maybe I should just get the fuck out of here. Pookie shook his head. He'd never really been afraid of his partner before, but at the moment, he was scared shitless of Brian the Ninja Clouser. But he was more afraid of what Brian might do on his own. The guy was an emotional wreck, and it didn't take a whole lot of pre-planning for a messed-up cop to swallow a bullet. If Pookie could have gone back in time, he'd have thrown Brian's ass in jail right after the Alex Panos murder. But Pookie couldn't go back in time. It was what it was. And as insane as all this shit was, the ninja was still his partner. The ninja had saved Pookie's life.
Let's go, Brian,
Pookie said. He got out of the car. Brian waited a moment, then followed. Frank Lanza sat in his grandfather's high-backed leather office chair, looking out at his lieutenants. Anthony Gutless Capistrano, who was anything but gutless, Pete the fucking Jew Goldblum, Polly the Hatchet Caprice, Thomas Little Tommy Cosimo, and of course, Tony Fourballs Gillum. These were good guys, a good crew. They sat and waited for Lanza to speak. The chair had been shipped over from a craftsman in Sicily some 80 years ago. Shipped from the Lanza's ancestral hometown. Grandpa had called it the War Chair. The chair resided in a basement office in a house on the crazy, angled stretch of Lombard Street. The street was actually a tourist attraction and drew plenty of traffic, but because of the street's sharp switchbacks, the traffic's top speed clocked in at about 3 miles an hour. There could be no drive-bys here. Did the Russians know about the safe house? Lanza couldn't say for sure. But if they did, they'd have to bring the farm, and they'd have to come on foot, because he had at least 30 armed men in the house at that very moment. Frank had seen the chair only once as a child. How many years ago? 40? He couldn't really remember. He'd been so little, maybe 7 years old. He remembered the fear, though. The fear of the Chinese tongs. They had wanted to reclaim San Francisco, take it back from the La Cosa Nostra. They'd butchered members of the Lanza organization, cut them up into little pieces, and tossed them into the bay. That was the reason for the fear, which seemed to permeate the entire safe house. Everyone had been afraid. Frank's mom, the capos and soldiers who walked around arms to the teeth, even Frank's own father, who had been maybe 25 at the time. Everyone seemed afraid. Everyone, except Frank's grandfather. The eldest Lanza had kicked everyone out of the office, save for Frank and Frank's father. He'd waved to Frank in that strange way he had, sticking his hand out, palm down, then flipping his fingers against the pad of his thumb. Frank had come, and Grandpa had lifted him up and bounced him softly on one knee.
Frankie, Grandfather had said, you know things are bad, yes?
Frank had nodded. Grandpa was talking to him, but even then, he had a feeling the message was only partially for him. Most of it was for his father.
Frankie, are you afraid?
Frankie had shrugged and said,
should I be?
That had made Grandfather smile. Grandpa was a man of little emotion. He seldom smiled, usually only when Frank said something that hinted at the promise of a great leader.
You always ask such good questions, Frankie,
Grandpa had said.
The answer is yes. You should be afraid. Everyone here should be afraid. But feeling fear and letting it run you, letting it control your thoughts, that is what you cannot do. Fear should make you think, but it should never make you run. Do you know why, Frankie?
Frankie had shaken his head.
Because you can only shoot what you're looking at, Grandpa had said. And when you run, you're not looking at your enemy,
But your enemy is looking at you.
That had made so much sense back then. It's so simple. Life had grown more complicated since those days. All the intricacies of leadership and politics and infighting grew and multiplied, making every step a minefield full of well-hidden traps. Things were complex, sure, but that lesson had never been lost on Frank. Because it really was that simple. The metaphor always held true. When you run, you're not looking at your enemy, and you can only shoot what you're looking at. Frank adjusted in the office chair, feeling the weight of his family legacy. Grandpa had nearly wiped out the Tongs. That was the Lanza way. When in trouble, you attack.
Gentlemen, Lanza said, we've been attacked. Right in our own fucking neighborhood, we have been attacked. What I want to know is, before I decide my course of action, I want to know what all of you think.
The men looked around the room, looking at each other. Most eyes seemed to hang on Tony Fourballs. Lanza assumed that would happen. Tony was his right-hand man. The other lieutenants would have tried to convince Tony to come around to their way of thinking. Whatever he said would speak volumes for the morale of the entire organization.
Boss, we gotta get out of town, Tony Fourballs said. Seriously, these fucking Russians are fucking crazy. They attack in the middle of the street. We gotta get some distance and figure out what to do next.
Lanza shook his head.
No, I don't run from my city.
But boss...
Give me your gun, Lanza said.
Tony took a step back.
What? Your gun, Tony. Give it to me.
Tony paused, then handed over his Sig Sauer P229. Lanza took it, then slowly lifted it, and put the barrel in the middle of Tony's forehead. Pete the fucking Jew Goldblum took a step forward. He was the bravest of them all, the one willing to push an argument right up to the edge of insubordination. He was also all of 5'4" and weighed maybe 120 soaking wet. Pete was a vicious motherfucker. Had to be the only Jew controlling a crew in the Lanza family. Frank didn't give a shit about that religion stuff, as long as his guys produced. And Pete always did.
Boss, Pete said, it's not like Tony isn't speaking for all of us.
But he's the one that spoke, Pete. He's the one that opened his fucking mouth.
Boss, come on, you don't have to do this.
Not another word, Pete. Sit down.
Pete sat. Tony swallowed.
Boss, I...
His words were cut off by a loud, metallic click as Frank reached up with his thumb and pulled back the hammer.
Be quiet, Tony, Lanza said softly. I want you to listen now. Can you listen?
Tony nodded slowly, as if nodding too fast might jostle the gun. The barrel dipped and rose with his nods, pressing firmly against the same spot on his forehead.
This is my city, Tony. Mine. I don't get run out of my city. My grandfather never got run out. My father never got run out.
Lanza's cell phone rang. With his left hand, he took it out and looked at the caller ID. Robertson. He hit ignore and just kept the phone in his hand.
We're not going anywhere, Tony, Lanza said.
He spoke louder to make sure the other men could hear him clearly.
I know every one of you real good. I know every man and every one of your crews. Nobody runs. Nobody leaves San Francisco until that fucking Russian and his fucking crew and their fucking families are fucking dead.
The cell phone in his hand rang again. He looked at the ID as a reaction. Robertson again. Lanza hit ignore.
You know why you do this, Tony? You know why we're not running?
Tony shrugged. Slowly. Just like how he had nodded.
Sun Tzu, boss?
Lanza smiled and nodded.
That's right, Tony. Sun Tzu. He once said, throw your soldiers into positions whence there is no escape, and they will prefer death to flight. If they will face death, there is nothing they may not achieve. Now let me ask you again, Tony, what do you think we should do?
Tony's eyes momentarily crossed as he looked up, each pupil drawing a beeline on the gun pressed against his forehead.
I think we should stay and fight, boss.
I agree, Lanza said. And I'm holding every man in this room personally accountable for his crew. I hear about anybody
leaving town, and his capo pays the price. Does everyone understand me?
Frank looked around as five heads nodded. His cell phone rang again. Frank took a peek at the ID, but knew what he'd see. Robertson. Lanza lowered the gun and handed it butt first to Tony Fourballs. Tony let out a sigh of relief so big that it seemed to deflate him for just a second. He took the gun, uncocked the hammer, and put the gun away. Frank Lanza answered the cell phone.
What the fuck is so important? When I want to talk to you, I'll answer. You got that? No, don't you...
Shut the fuck up.
What did you say to me?
I said shut the fuck up. Did it sound different the second time? I need you to listen, Lanza, or the Russians will be the last of your worries.
Frank's hand tightened on the cell phone. Robertson had never spoke so disrespectfully before. The guy was a fucking cop, sure, but he also knew where his bread was buttered. Robertson sounded stressed. Real stressed.
Go ahead.
Those problems I told you about before, the ones looking for your special friends, it's worse.
How much worse?
I think they know. I think they know everything about him. They may not know about your relationship, but they know everything else. I suspended one of them. The other, I'm still figuring out what to do.
Is suspension gonna do the trick?
There was a long pause as Robertson thought it over.
No,
he said finally. Lanza nodded. It wouldn't be the first time he'd ordered a cop's death.
Do my friends need to pay him a visit?
It's more complicated than that. I need to see you.
Now is not the time for that.
You gotta make time, Lanza. This problem, it's big. I need your help. I gotta see you, now.
Go to the park, alone. Someone'll be there shortly.
He hung up.
Tony, go pick up Robertson. Pete, your crew escorts him. If Robertson isn't alone, you kill him. He's alone, you bring his ass back here. You see the Russians, you kill those motherfuckers.
Tony nodded, much faster than when he'd had a gun to his forehead, and ran out the door. Pete Goldblum followed, much slower, more calm.
And the rest of you, go talk to your men. Nobody leaves San Francisco. We stay here, and we fight until the Russians are dead.
And now a quick word from the sponsor of this free episode, Green Chef, a USDA-certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. They send the meals to be made right to your door. The boxes contain all the ingredients and full instructions, letting you make a restaurant-style meal right in your own dang kitchen. Since you can't go out, why not do date night or family dinner at home? Meal plans include paleo, plant-powered, keto, and balanced living. Green Chef makes cooking easy with dinner options that work around your lifestyle, not the other way around. Let Green Chef do the meal planning, grocery shopping, and most of the prep for you week after week. Recipes include pre-made measured sauces, dressings, and spices so you can get more flavor in less time. Playa. A real girl and I have mowed down on Green Chef, and let me tell you, I'm not lying. This stuff is good. The white bean sandwich was legit, and the Japanese fritters, oh my God. Oh my God, so good. A real girl and I used Green Chef for that date night experience while staying at home to try and help flatten that curve. Check it out at greenchef.com/Sigler80. That URL saves $80 off your first month, plus gets you free shipping on your first box. That URL again is greenchef.com, S-I-G-L-E-R, the number 8, the number 0. That link alone gets you 80% off your first month, free shipping on the first box, and night out meals where you never leave your COVID-free home. And now, the conclusion of Nocturnal Throwback episode number 25.
Robin Hudson and Stonemason stood in the back room of Bing Majerus's taxidermy shop. They stared at the thing on top of the stainless steel table. It looked like a dog, sort of. A huge, muscular dog with one big eye in the middle of its forehead. And pincers, Robin thought. Don't forget the giant black pincers. And yet Robin's advanced knowledge of physiology saw things that Brian had completely missed. like the fur-covered paws. They weren't paws at all. They were hands. The fingers were very thin and wedged together, and they sort of looked like paws, but if you looked close enough, you couldn't miss the opposable thumb. There it was. That thing was no more a dog than she was.
"Well," Stone said, "that's really something."
Bing walked up to the thing and gently petted it.
"It is at that."
"Well, that can't be for real," Robin said.
"Robin, please, do the math. Your boyfriend wouldn't have sent us to a taxidermist at 4 a.m. if it wasn't real."
"Boyfriend," Bing said. "That dreamy detective is your boyfriend?" "He's not my boyfriend."
Stone patted Robin on the back.
"I'm afraid my colleague here is in a perpetual state of denial when it comes to her love life. She and Detective Dreamy have quite a history."
"A shame. I was hoping he batted for the other team, which is to say, my team."
Robin was exhausted, but what was new? Bing Majerus looked fresh as a daisy, as if working at 4 a.m. was nothing new to him. Stone at least looked a little tired, thank God. It was about time someone other than her felt the fatigue of all this bullshit. She needed another Benny.
"You and Detective Clouser have something in common," Bing said to her. "You'd both be rather good-looking people if you ever got any sleep."
"Thanks," Robin said. "You know how to make a girl feel special."
Bing kept petting the dog creature.
"I hate to let it go," he said. "It's really quite fabulous. But Detective Clouser said I could only release it to you."
Stone picked up the stuffed creature as if it were a holy relic.
"Well, thank you, Mr. Majerus. Now, if you don't mind, we'll be on our way."
Bing saw Robin and Stone out, then locked up behind them. Stone put the thing in the back seat, buckling it down firmly. Robin wondered if she could sleep on the drive back. The way Stone was practically vibrating in the driver's seat, she knew that wasn't going to happen. He drove out onto the road, and they headed back toward San Francisco.
"Tell me again," Stone said. "How many creatures did Brian say were in that basement?"
"He didn't know. Maybe 20 or 30.
"And they were all different. They weren't all like the amazing creature in the back seat there."
"Well, he said there were all kinds of creatures. He didn't say they were all different, but that's the impression I got."
Stone nodded. He was leaning forward, hands clutched on the steering wheel.
"When we run analysis on this, lovely, you know what we're going to find?"
"Don't even tell me we're going to find the Z chromosome," Robin said. "Stone, just look at the thing. It's not even human. Not even close."
"Robin, stop it," Stone said. "You saw the hand as well as I did. At the very least, it's in the primate family. And since there is somewhat of a shortage of primates in the Bay Area, but at least 4 individuals with a said chromosome in that same area, I'm laying 3-1 that our backseat driver is carrying the Zed. The only phenotypes we've seen are Marco Gastineau and Rex Depravdichuk. There's also the killers of Kyle Soler and Alex Panos, whom we have not seen."
"But they can't look like that."
Robin jerked her thumb towards the back seat. Stone shrugged.
"And why not? Remember the tooth marks on Alex Panos?"
Robin paused. She did remember. A perp with a really wide mouth. A mouth so wide, in fact, it might not even be human. She turned in the passenger seat to look at the dog thing. The lights of nighttime traffic played off of it, making it seem to move just a bit. Robin imagined what it must have been like when it was alive. Those muscles bunching as it ran. Those pincers reaching out for prey.
"But Stone, how can something with human DNA look like that?"
"Evolution, my dear."
"Evolution is random changes, Stone. This is a whole different thing entirely. It would take millions of years for that to evolve from us."
Stone nodded.
"Normally, you'd be right. But ever since this started, ever since we saw that Zed chromosome, I've been thinking. How does a species move into a new niche? How does a species, say, take advantage of a new food source? Random mutation covers a lot of things, but not everything. Have you heard of the boxer crab?"
Robin shook her head.
"A boxer crab, or Libya tessellata, cuts sea anemones off the rocks and glues them to its claws. When the crab faces predators, it holds up its claws like a boxer raising his guard, hence the name. Predators recognize the stinging anemones as a bad thing, so they leave the crab alone."
"So, that's just instinct, right?"
Stone nodded.
"Using the sea anemones as a defensive weapon? Sure, it's instinct. But that begs the question, Robin. How does random mutation cause a creature, a supposedly non-intelligent creature, like a crab, to arrive at such a perfectly formed strategy?
Stone, please tell me there's not an evangelist Bible in your bag of many tricks. You're not going all creationist on me, are you?
Stone shook his head, clearly annoyed once again at Robin's slowness.
Evolution is a collection of random genetic changes that provides a survival advantage. But tell me what random behavior can lead to a box crab strategy?
Well, I don't know, maybe their ancestor had a behavioral anomaly or something that caused them to pick up whatever they had handy and wave it at predators.
That strategy will have zero success until one stumbles on the anatomy. And we have to keep in mind this initial mutation, by necessity, begins with a single individual. So with a random behavioral quirk that causes an individual to pick up whatever shit is handy and wave it at a predator that's closing in for the kill, what are the chances of that individual surviving to pass on its genes?
Robin paused and gave this some thought. Even if the crab did have some mutation that made it pick things up, it might grab a rock, stick, piece of seaweed, any number of things that wouldn't stop said predator from munching down.
Not so great, she said finally.
And that's the thing, my dear. Throughout nature, there are little examples of strategies so successful, so complex, so perfect, it's damn near impossible to imagine a collection of small mutations adding up to provide a definitive survival advantage to an animal, when all the interim changes needed to get from Form A to Form B provide no survival advantage at all.
Okay, fine. So that's one example.
You want more? How about the anglerfish? You ever seen one of those ugly buggers?
Robin nodded. She had seen the fish, which sort of looked like a bowling ball with a big mouth and a bone sticking out of its forehead, a bone that had a little wavy piece of flesh on the end. The anglerfish would sit perfectly still, waving that little piece of flesh on the end of that long bony spine enough to draw in baitfish. Baitfish would swim up to the flesh thinking they were going to get the meal. When it got close enough, the anglerfish would open its giant mouth, suck the baitfish in, and swallow it whole.
Okay, so you've seen that little lure they use to draw in baitfish. Now that's on the end of a dorsal spine, which is part of the dorsal fin, which is part of the fish's system of locomotion. Somewhere along the line, this lone spine separated from the rest of the fin, grew to 10 times its original length, then added that protuberance. Now, of course, you'll argue that it came in small stages that provided some unique survival advantage, but what would those interim states be? Because it sure isn't just one random mutation that gives it that advantage. Just a long, isolated dorsal spine sticking out the front of its head isn't really going to convey a survival advantage at all. Again, the steps between Form A and Form B, they don't provide a significant survival advantage. Only the full development of Form B provides that advantage. You want more? The sea urchin crab carries the Cassiopeia jellyfish on its back, using it for camouflage and protection. Hides under there, you can't even see the little bugger. Like the boxer crab, how does a random mutation cause the first crab to pick this thing up, flip it over, and wear it like a backpack? And if those examples don't do it for you, Robin, how about the fact that the first ants that learned how to farm fungus appeared some 50 million years ago? Since then, 200 species have evolved, but Robin, it had to start somewhere, especially with ants, since they are all bred from one queen. There had to be some drastic shift where the queen stumbled on this new strategy and passed it down to subsequent generations.
Passed down a strategy? Come on, Stone. You're talking about Lamarckian evolution. If I had a son and he lifts weights and adds tons of muscle, it doesn't mean my grandson will be born with tons of muscle. You don't pass down the actual acquired traits. Only the potential to acquire those traits is passed down.
All right, Robin, what is instinct?
It's instinct. Things insects or animals do without being trained, without observing others with that same behavior.
So if an animal learns how to do something, that's not instinct.
Right. If it sees something, it remembers it and it repeats it.
So it acts on a learned memory, performs some task.
Right.
But why is instinct any different? Instinct makes an animal act, makes it perform some task. It's the same thing as a learned memory, only it's not learned. It's born with this knowledge. A complex instinct, say like a bird building a nest, that's not a random collection of mutated behaviors. That's engineering. And even if an egg is removed from the nest so that the hatchling never sees a nest, When that individual matures and mates, he or she will still build a nest and build it to the same exact engineering standards, the right circumference, the right materials, etc.
Robin opened her mouth to speak, then closed it.
Stone, what you're doing is defining instinct as inherited memories.
Exactly. How else can you describe the phenomenon? Just because you're born knowing how to do it doesn't make it any different than an acquired memory. That's what instinct is, Robin. Memories you're born with.
Robin wanted a Benny. Wanted it bad. Maybe she could get Stone to stop and grab a snack. Then she could pop one.
All right then, Stone. Why doesn't Lamarckian evolution happen then? Why won't my kids be born knowing all about forensics?
I think that's because you're not an alpha member of the species. I think that periodically, there are superorganisms in any species. An alpha, if you will, that's capable of rewriting the genetic code.
An alpha member of the species? What, you mean like, you know, some John Alpha might learn canasta, and his kids are born knowing how to play? That's fucking impossible.
You agree that instincts are pre-programmed memories? Memories that are coded into the germline DNA that's passed down from generation to generation?
Robin nodded, knowing she was being led down a path, but unable to do anything about it.
Then here's the bottom line. It's possible, entirely possible, that these alpha individuals can rewrite their germline DNA so that these learned memories are coded and passed down to the next generation. In fact, I'd say it goes beyond possible. Occam's razor dictates that this is by far the most likely way some of these complex instincts are passed down. An alpha individual sees a niche and understands how to capitalize on it. It learns a skill that not only keeps it alive, it provides a survival advantage for all subsequent progeny.
Robin slowly shook her head. This was crazy talk. She needed time to think about it. And yet, it did make sense. Take the anglerfish. Maybe a distant ancestor has a mutation that makes one of its dorsal spines have a growth that the other anglerfish ancestors didn't have. That might bring in a baitfish or two, but would it be enough to make that one mutant has such a significant survival advantage over the others in its species that it survives, its offspring survive, and at a higher rate? It was difficult to say. If a mutation did provide an advantage, it would only be a small one. Stone was talking about arriving at a new physical adaptation, fully formed.
Wait a minute. I got lost there for a second. You're talking about a decision-making crab that makes a behavioral change passed down to the next generation, right?
What we're talking about here is rewriting germline DNA, Stone said. Yeah, I believe that it's possible.
But coding for memories and coding for physiological changes are two different things. A decision-making crab and an anglerfish intentionally changing its physiology are two completely different things.
Why? They're not different at all. It's proteins, Robin. Either way, it's rearranging nucleic acids. Everything we are, every memory, every instinct, every physical and mental limit we can reach, it's programmed into us at the point of conception. Nearly an endless sequence of adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. AGTC. That's it, and that's all. Everything is made from that, whether it be instincts, arms, legs, or fur. Or, say, a person with pincers on his head. Once you've established that it's possible that there is a mechanism that can change the germline DNA so that the changes are passed down, well, hell, all manner of things are possible.
This is ridiculous. Organisms can't consciously change their DNA.
And if our little friend in the back seat turns out to have a Z chromosome, if, as I suspect, he turns out to be the brother of Marco Gastineau, Rex Depravdichuk, Solar's Killer, and Panos' Killer, what then, my little Robin? Are you going to tell me that random DNA changes from the same mother resulted in at least three different forms? Human, the dog creature, and whatever the hell chewed on Panos' bones?
Stone, you're giving me a headache. This is retarded. Organisms that can control their genetic code? What's the mechanism then? How would it work?
What's the mechanism behind sentience? Stone asked. How does your self-awareness work? We don't know what makes us sentient when, as far as we know, other animals with the same biochemistry aren't. But we're still sentient. Just because we don't know how it works doesn't make it any less real, Robin.
I'm not talking about this anymore. I'm going to close my eyes and I'm going to sleep. Wake me up when we get back to San Francisco. You wake me up before and I swear, Stone, I can't be held responsible for my actions.
You have been listening to Nocturnal, written and performed by Scott Sigler. For more information, go to scottsigler.com. All music in this podcast provided by Uncrowned off their album Devils and Angels, available now at the iTunes Music Store.